Mancini. We're on the air. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Gippsville, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, it's John McMullen, John Mack, to some welcome you to the 196th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The links to recordings of the previous 195 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C. That's johnmack13.com. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newspaper at my web home. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the country and the world. Articles relating to politics, sports, books, the environment, arts, entertainment, opinion, and technology. Try it and subscribe. It's only one email per day, and it's free. So once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. I hope you'll join us not only tonight, but every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evenings live, or as most do listen later. Next week is an exception to the every week. Next Saturday, I'll be giving the presentation at the Hagen Cyber Summer Symposium held at Iona College in Neuchâtel, New York, the subject, getting the message out in the global digital world. Speaking about such subjects as hosting a radio show like this and producing an internet newspaper. At any rate, on the next day, I'll be taking the post-conference vacation day to tour the Hudson Valley. However, I'll come roaring back on Sunday, July 23rd, when my guest will be writer and independent publisher, Rogue Sam Bland. Now, to this show, the 196th, as I mentioned, callers may call in at any time during this show by dialing 646-716-9756. And that is 646-716-9756. I usually hold calls until near the end of the interview with my guest. My guest tonight is scheduled to be Karen Lynch, writer, San Francisco Police Department veteran and author of Good Cop, Bad Daughter. I read Karen's book about a month ago. She's a very interesting story to tell. And upon finishing the book, I immediately asked to join us here. Unfortunately, she hasn't arrived yet. She's in San Francisco, and it's quite possible that the time got fouled up. I sp- I spoke to as recently as yesterday, and she was set to be on. However, an old friend to the show, who has been my guest more time than anyone, has jumped in to sign on for at least for a short conversation. Good evening, Chick Donahue.
Good evening, John McMullen.
And how are you tonight?
I'm just peachy. I'm sitting down here in hot Florida, getting ready to travel to Ireland this Wednesday and to celebrate my birthday tomorrow. I'll be 76 tomorrow. Whoever thought I'd last this?
I might not have growing up in Inwood. And how long would you be in Ireland for? Where will you be staying?
I'll be staying with my daughter out and with her and her children, husband and children, out in West Cork, out near Bantry Bay, a town called Kilcrahan in Cork. I'll be there for 6 weeks.
And I remember standing down in Rockaway in the door of the Mickey Carnes Mayo House, where you were the bungalow down there, where Bill McLaughlin and I stayed in your aunt's bungalow. Listening to Ruthie Morrissey sing The Boys from the County Cork, up the boys from Boston and New York, but the boys to beat the black and tan with the boys from the County Cork. Do you remember that?
I do remember that. I remember everything you said. I even remember a good part of the song, though I'm not going to sing it to you.
Okay. For the audience that's not familiar, and you should be, because he and his co-author, Joanna Malloy, have been on a number of times talking about Chick's recent book that he's been doing the book tour for, the greatest beer run ever, a true story of friendships stronger than war. Where have you been appearing, Chick, to do your book signings?
Well, mostly around New York, you know, up in Woodlawn and Yonkers, and I was in Long Beach, and I was at the American Irish Historical Society a couple of weeks back, and we're making plans for this fall. We're going to be at a Good Shepherd event in sometime in the middle of October, and we're going to do a thing up in Coogan's, up in the Heights. I think the tentative date is October 4th, so that I don't know if that's been nailed down yet. I've been doing mostly interviews past couple of weeks, and we did one for the Wave, the Rockaway Wave, that should have come out today. And there's one in Food and Wine magazine. I did one for the New York Times that appeared last month, and for the Irish Voice that appeared a week or two ago.
What's the name of the Rockaway paper?
The Wave, the Rockaway Wave.
And where did you appear in Long Beach?
Well, where was I in Long Beach?
You were there last August, but that was before the book came out, I remember.
You know what? 3 weeks ago, I was in Long Beach, Washington State.
Oh,
a beautiful town. And I met with some veterans out there. But I've been mostly around New York.
And what were you doing out in Washington State, Chick?
My wife and I were touring around Oregon and Washington and then up to Alaska. I'm retired, John. I can go wherever I want now and visit with whom I want and not have to fill out any forms.
And how did you get hooked up with the veterans in Washington
State?
Well,
through I'm a member of the American Legion down here in Pompano. And ever since we come out with the book, I was contacted by a number of veterans as a result, first, of the video that Pabst Blue Ribbon put on YouTube. And I became active down here, and they've been putting me in touch with the veterans, the DAV, Disabled Veterans of America, and other veterans groups.
So you did some book signings in the Pompano Beach area?
Yeah, well, I didn't have the books when they didn't even, I didn't have enough books for them, but they invited me to come and speak. We've shown the video and things like that.
Probably in the winter when the snowbirds start coming down, the Jupiter area is a good place for you. That's heavily loaded with Inwood people, obviously.
Well, actually, I met some Inwood people at the veterans event and also at the same American Legion Hall that I belong to now down here. They host a meeting every year of retired New York City firefighters.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, the Holland, is it Joe Holland from Inwood? He lives down here now.
And
Bill he's a member there.
And Bill Callahan lives down there.
Well, Billy's up in Jupiter.
He's in Jupiter, right.
Yeah, Joe Holland is closer to Pompano Beach, though it's not, he doesn't live in Pompano Beach, but close enough.
Then how long have you been down Pompano, Chick?
Oh, I bought down here about 5 years ago. I've been a snowbird for years. I loved it down here. I can't take them cold, never could take the cold winters. And I love telling my friends up north that, you know, I've never heard of anybody slipping on the sand down here in the wintertime and breaking a hip. That was enough for me.
You mentioned to me that you started off in Hutchinson Island where Terry Chigrou's in the process buying.
That was the first place I had was in Hutchinson Island, and God, that was back in the early 80s. And then for years, I used to attend union meetings down at the old Sheridan Hotel in Bal Harbour, and I rented a condo there, a studio condo, from a Holocaust survivor, and who was a socialist and a trade unionist. And we became good friends, and I would spend a few weeks or a month or so every winter down there. And when he passed on, he left instructions to give Chick an opportunity to buy it. So I did buy that place, and it was great fun. But I sold that. I went into retirement, and I only own this one here now in Pompano, and this is where my wife and I live.
Speaking of old socialists, and I was about to bring something up about Inwood, but I'll get to that in a minute. Did you even know Eric Haas from Inwood?
I believe he's the guy. Did he run for president a couple of times?
He ran for president a number of times on the socialist ticket, and I ran across him, not in Inwood, but he was the librarian. This was after his political career was over, but he was a librarian at a Trinity church, and he was the chairperson of the photography club down there. I wound up taking it over for him when he retired. And for a long time, he had looked around in different places to retire, and he and his wife decided that the best place that they could go for the most services and the best weather was in Costa Rica. And they've been there a number of times. He was really looking forward to it. And I heard the year after he retired that he was back in the United States. Apparently, it was the nice place for him to visit, but not to live. Had you ever run across him? You said you knew he ran for president.
Well, believe it or not, when I was in Good Shepherd as a student, I used to work for G's Candy Store newsstand on 207th and Cooper. And I would work there from, I think, 6 in the morning until like 7:45 and then go up the block to class. And he used to come by there and pick up the paper. And I don't remember if it was the what was the Pravda or some sort of the Communist Workers Party paper.
It was the Daily Worker was the Communist paper.
Okay. Well, I think he used to pick it up. I think he was actually a communist. I think he was a registered communist and ran as a communist.
He ran as the socialist because I checked all that out. I see that we have a caller from the San Francisco area. That may be my scheduled guest. I'll pick her up.
Yes. Hi.
Hello, Karen. How are you tonight?
I'm good. How are you, John? I'm sorry. I had a little problem getting through there for some reason.
Well, I don't know if you've been listening, but an old friend from my neighborhood, Chick Donahue, who's also the published author, jumped into the fray. Chick has a book out called The Greatest Beer Run Ever, and the details have that he, as the next Marine, but as the merchant Marine, delivered us some beer to people from my old neighborhood that were in Vietnam. They decided during the protests in New York against the war that seemed to spill over and be the protest against the fighting people that someone should go to Vietnam and buy the guys a beer. And since Chick had merchant seaman papers, he decided to do it, and he hitched around Vietnam, sometimes in places that he shouldn't be. And he, unfortunately for him, got caught up in the Tet Offensive. But he lived to tell
that
about it.
That sounds like a really interesting story, yeah. What's the name of his book?
The Greatest Beer Run Ever, and it's the true story of friendships stronger than war. It's co-authored by Chick Donahue and by J.T. Malloy. And J.T. Malloy is Joanna Malloy, who is who is the next columnist for New York Daily News. Chick, can you stay with us? I'll go through Karen's story, and you may have some questions, or do you have someplace to be?
Well, I'll hang out, John. I'll listen.
Okay. I talked about the book and partially about your background, Karen. Let's start off. Good evening. Welcome to the show, Karen.
Thank you.
I'm really
happy to be here.
Where did you first grow up and go to early school? I use the word because I know that you grew up and you went to school in a number of the places. So start at the beginning.
Yes. Yeah, I moved to 22 different places by the time I was 21 or something. But I started out in San Francisco in the Haight-Ashbury, and my parents came to San Francisco from the East Coast to be beatniks. They were writers, and they wanted to be part of the whole Ferlinghetti, Kerouac, you know, the whole scene, the whole on the road scene. So they came to North Beach. And so I was born in San Francisco and grew up there. And my mother took me all over the place during her different adventures, which I'm using the word adventures loosely.
When did you first realize that something wasn't quite right with your mother and with you traveling all over?
Well, my mother, more or less, I didn't realize that she had kidnapped me until I became older, but my mother more or less kidnapped me from my father when I was five and took me to the East Coast, and he was searching for us. And at that time, I kind of knew there was something not quite right, but I don't think I really realized she was my normal. You know, when you're a kid, whatever you are living with is normal for you, you know? And so I didn't realize until probably 7 or 8 that she was not like other people's mothers.
Do you remember what your first aspirations were for you growing up?
Yeah, well, after she took me to the East Coast and my father eventually tracked us down and he tried to put the marriage back together, but that didn't work. And there were a series of sort of crazy breakdowns. And during one of them, she hooked up with this boyfriend who took us to Japan, and we ended up living there for many months. And one of my first memories of Japan is being lost towards the end of our visits there, the end of the time we spent there. She just kind of disappeared and left me in this market. And so I was roaming around by myself, trying to, you know, not speaking the language, not knowing what to do. And that was sort of the first memory of something really strange, unusual, I guess, in a public place, although she had done other odd things before that, which I talk about in the book, and just bizarre stuff that, you know, I had no context for it. One of the things that my mother did, and she was eventually diagnosed as bipolar, at the time they called it manic depressive, but she isolated me from any other family members that could have possibly given me a context to know what normal behavior was. So, you know, to me, she was normal at that time.
You mentioned that they both wanted to be writers. Was that your first aspiration? You're the writer now. Did you want to be the writer when you were very young?
I think that was always in the back of my mind. And I think I also always knew that my story was kind of unique or, you know, bizarre. I mean, everybody's got a story, and everybody's story is interesting. But I knew that growing up in the summer of love with hippie parents, because that's essentially what happened down the road. My mother and stepfather opened a head shop and sold posters and buttons and things like that. And we marched in every peace march and things like that. While all this was going on, you know, to grow up and then become a cop, I think I knew there was a certain irony to that, or, you know, something interesting in that story. People would always ask me things about that. And I always liked to write, so I kind of knew that someday I would write the story.
Once we were out of the country, you through no fault of your own, wound up in an orphanage kind of place. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, one of my mother's dreams was to live in England for a year, and my mother didn't have any money. It wasn't like we had all this money and we traveled the world. My mother would save her SSI checks, or she would get money from boyfriends, somehow just scrounge the money together, and then take me on these bizarre trips to different places. So one of her dreams had been to live in England for a year. And the first time we tried to go there, I was 12 or 13. I was 13. And we got on a ship, and we were going to go through the Panama Canal and take the ship across the Atlantic and end up in Southampton and spend a year in England. But right around Acapulco, my mother started melting down. And so on that trip, she ended up in the brig, and I ended up wandering this cruise ship for several days until we finally got to Florida, to an American port where they could take us off the ship. And so that was our first attempt to go to England. And about a year later, she got it together again to try this again. And we made it to England, and we actually lived there for almost a year. And at the end of the year, she had another breakdown and ended up in a mental hospital. And since I had nobody else there, they put me in this children's home. And so I got to have this sort of bizarre, almost Dickensian kind of children's home experience. It was a very strange place, but it was interesting, too.
Your mother's personality swings, as well as her attractiveness and enthusiasm, led to quasi-permanent relationships with a number of men. And in some cases, you were encouraged to use their last name. This must have been rather confusing for you.
Yeah, it definitely was. I mean, especially in Japan, I was only 5 or 6, and she really wanted to encourage me to use her boyfriend's last name because he was working there, and we were supposed to be his wife and child. And in order for me to masquerade as the wife and child, as the child, I had to, you know, pretend that my name was something else. And even at that age, I knew that that was not right, you know.
You actually formed a long-term parental relationship with one of these men than you had with your natural father. And that relationship didn't do it long after his relationship with your mother dissolved. He must have been a very unusual man. Tell us about him.
Yes. Yeah, Jim was really a special person. He was one of my mother's boyfriends and the one who lived with us the longest. My mother and he moved in when I was about 7, and they were together on and off for many years. And after her last breakdown, which I was about 16, I really had nowhere to go. They took her off to Napa State Hospital, and I was basically homeless and still had nobody except my school friends, who I was really too embarrassed to tell how bad things had gotten. And I ended up calling Jim, who was my mother's ex-boyfriend, even though they had been split up for some time. And I told him I have nowhere to go. And he took me in. And, you know, we always hear these horrible stories about older men taking advantage of younger kids and stuff. And in my case, it was the exact opposite. Jim was a really, really good guy. He had been an orphan as a child and had been adopted. And so I think he just viewed me as being his other kid. And his two kids, his biological kids, lived with their mother. But I lived with him all through the rest of high school, and he was just always there for me and really a good guy.
Tell us about your high school years. How well did you do after all this moving around and jerking around? And had your aspiration changed by then?
Well, high school, all of school, as a matter of fact, for me, was sort of a safe haven. You know, this was before the years of Columbine and school shootings and all these kinds of things. So for me, going to school was the one place where I always knew it was safe and nobody would hurt me and nothing bad would happen, in my illusions anyway. Nothing bad could ever happen at school. So I was lucky enough to go to some very good schools. I got to go to Lowell, which is one of the best public high schools in San Francisco, and it's a college prep school. So that helped me get into UC Berkeley and things like that. So I was able to get an education and work my way through college, and between scholarships and working 30 hours a week or so at a pharmacy, I was able to pay my way through college and all that. And I'm sure I couldn't do that today because it's a lot more expensive to try to do that now.
What did you study in college?
I was going to be a nurse, and then after failing organic chemistry twice, I finally realized that nursing was really not my mission in life. It was really more what my mother had always wanted me to do. And at that time, they had started advertising that they wanted women to be San Francisco police officers. And it was right around the time that Charlie's Angels was popular, and I would watch that show and think, oh, that's interesting. I never even thought, because growing up, I'd never seen a woman in uniform on patrol. That just didn't happen. It was not something that happened until about 1978 or 9, I think they first started hiring in San Francisco. And so I decided that was something that called to me, and it just, once I got the idea in my head, it was like something I could not let go, and I had to keep on pursuing it. And I guess the ironic part of it was as much as they were advertising that they wanted women, I wasn't aware that the fact of the matter was they didn't really want women, but they had been compelled by court order to hire us. So I came into a situation where I thought they all wanted us so much, but they really did not want us.
You mentioned in the book that even though that idea had struck you as interesting, that it had faded a bit into the background until you actually saw a woman in a patrol car. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was a freaky situation. So before I was, in between sort of college and getting into the police academy, for a while I was a serving wench at this bar in San Francisco called Ben Johnson's, which was a funny old Renaissance-style bar where the girls had to wear these ridiculous push-up corset things that they used to wear, I guess, in Renaissance times, or so they thought anyway. And on my days off sometimes, as many people who work in bars often do, we would go drink in another bar. And I happened to be drinking an Irish coffee with my best friend at Vesuvio's bar, which also happened to be the place that my parents had first met. And I had never really been in that bar before, but for some reason it was like sort of one of these destiny things. I was there and I was upstairs drinking this Irish coffee, and I looked out the window and I saw what I believed was myself. I know that sounds insane, but I thought I saw myself driving a police car. And as it turned out later, I met the woman who was driving the car, and she looks very much like me, and she ended up being my mentor. But at the time I looked out the window and I saw this, and I felt like the universe was sending me some kind of message. And I turned to my friend and said, you know, I think I'm supposed to do this. And so the next day, my boss at the bar that I was working in and the cannery had been a San Francisco cop. And I said, you know, I had this really weird idea the other day. I was thinking I might want to do this, you know, be a police officer. And he said, you know, I think you'd be really good at it. And he actually turned in the application for me.
One of the nicest bars that I was ever in, and this goes back well over 30 years ago, was in Giardelli Square. And I think it was called the Sea Witch or something. They'd sing in there at night.
Oh, yeah.
And
that was a great place.
Your mother took a rather spirited exception to your choice of employment, did she not? You're on the internet radio, and you can use whatever language that your mother actually used here.
Okay. All right. Well, since you've given me the go-ahead, then I'll go ahead and let it fly. Yeah, she told me I was becoming a fucking Nazi, and that, you know, I was a stormtrooper, and, you know, I couldn't have picked a profession that would have made her hate my profession more. And because of the kind of issues that she had, everything was about her in a sort of narcissistic way. So it was her reaction to it was, how could you do this to me? And, you know, just what I need, my daughter's becoming a Nazi and that kind of thing. So it was not good at all. And I lived in fear of both in the beginning of her somehow outing me to all of my friends as not being a so-called normal person. You know, I was trying so hard to fit into this cult of police work where, you know, there's a lot of conformity and everybody tries to get along and be like the others. And my fear during a lot of that time was that she would show up and just embarrass me the way she had repeatedly throughout my childhood. And then later on, my fear became that I would end up having to arrest her. So that went from there.
Going into an SFPD training environment that wasn't especially welcoming to women, was it? Tell us about that.
No. Yeah, most of the older guys really were not excited about the idea of women coming in the department. They had not had to deal with that before, and now suddenly this was being imposed on them, and they felt there were a lot of beliefs that women were taking jobs away from breadwinners, that men needed the jobs to support their families, and that women were just, you know, causing trouble, and that we were all a bunch of feminist nuts. And but you know, that was more from the really old-timer guys. The guys who were my age and who kind of came in with me and around the same time, the vast majority of them didn't know anything different. So they kind of judged us as individuals. And so I would say that most of the instructors of the academy were not all that excited about having women, but most of them also knew that they had no choice but to at least attempt to train the women because of the court order.
How large was your training class, and how many women were in it?
We started with 45 people, and we had 4 women, including me. And at the end, we graduated 21 people, and I ended up being the only woman who graduated. And that wasn't because I was so fabulous or anything. It was just because they really wore the other 3 women down to the point where they decided to leave. And because at that point, I stayed. So that's how that went.
How were you made to feel uncomfortable, and how did you get through it?
Well, that's kind of where there are a lot of stories in the book about things that happened, but mostly it was a general sense that we don't want you here, and that was said. It's both spoken and not spoken. It was just understood, and a sense that they were going to make things as hard as they could or as uncomfortable as they could so that we would want to quit. And the final blow, I guess, was they would tell you things like you were going to get fired for something if you did not quit, that you had a chance to quit and come back. But if you did not pass whatever this particular thing, the subjective test that they would come up with, for instance, one of the tests was the baton dance, they called it. And there was this very elaborate, multi-stepped martial arts type dance we had to learn with the baton. And it was only, it's not like shooting a target where you can tell if the person's hit the target or not. It's a very subjective thing. So a person could say, someone who is evaluating you could say, oh, you took a step over here you weren't supposed to take. I'm failing you. And so they'd fail you again and again on really silly things. And I would do these things in front of my classmates and they'd say, I don't see you doing any mistakes. You're doing it just the way I do it. And then they'd fail you. So they'd fail you again and again and again. And the point was to try to get you to quit. And if you didn't quit and you stuck it out, eventually, in my case anyway, they eventually passed me.
One of the interesting things that I saw in the book was the, you mentioned that you were being shown how to do things. And in this case, it was to go over a barricade or the fence. And that they've been training you in a way that the men did. And someone pointed out that women's bodies were different and it was a better way for you to do it. And that worked. But no one had told you that.
Right.
Am I right about this?
Yes. I mean, there are very few. One of the things we had to do just to get into the academy, the physical test was you had to climb over a 6-foot wall, which, you know, it was all timed and you had to run and you had to do this and that. And most women can't vault over a 6-foot wall unless the woman's an incredibly athletic, tall person. And there are a few women who can do that. You know, I'm sure Serena Williams could do it with the blindfold on, but most of us cannot do that, whereas the men can. But if you practice enough climbing over it, which is just like pulling yourself up and at the same time putting one foot in the middle and then throwing yourself over, you can get over almost as fast as someone who vaults over it.
Now, coincidentally, my fill-in guest and old friend, Chick Donahue, they're still on. He was the labor organizer for many years, both for the...
Oh, great. I love labor organizers.
Did you get any support from the police union?
No, and in fact, it was kind of the opposite. The police union really did not want the women to join, and the women sort of, in the lawsuit that happened in the 70s, African-American officers, and I'm not sure if other races as well, maybe some Asian officers, I don't even know, but I know African-American officers sued the city because they wanted representation in the police department. And at some point, the women who wanted to be hired joined that lawsuit. And that's how, you know, we all became part of the same lawsuit. But the Police Officers Association was not really excited about having women either. And, you know, they represent the rank and file, and the majority of men did not really want this. They saw no reason for it. And I think now the point of view has really changed, that people see that women are of value in police departments and that it's not all about brawn and, you know, how strong you are and all that, which of course is important, but it's not all of it.
You may have seen in the news that a female officer in NYPD was assassinated more or less last week here. And one of my good friends is a female officer who lives in the area. And as I think I mentioned to you, I come from a long line, father, grandfather, godfather of NYPD. Chick, you mentioned last night when I was speaking to you that you, in your labor work, did some coordination with Pat Lynch and NYPD union. Did they ever say anything about females, or were the females represented in a patrolman's union?
I never heard of I'm sure there was, but I've never heard of an issue of female police officers with the PBA. No. I mean, I belonged to, for years, a father-son union is how they would describe it. You needed to be a son of a member in order to be a member. That has since changed, but we changed our bylaws to, we were trying to protect that father-son. We changed our bylaws to father and daughter. If you were a son or a daughter of a sandhog, you should have been, you could be admitted to the union. And I remembered some of the guys on the floor during a debate of changing the rules said, you know, they didn't want that. And we pointed out, how many sandhogs do you know would want to bring their daughters into the tunnels anyway? Eventually, some of them did, but very few, very few. And we never were involved in those days. I'm going back in the 70s. There were many lawsuits going on about racial discrimination and gender discrimination. And the Sandhogs had great history with that because they were an integrated union since the foundation of the Brooklyn Bridge. There was always, and probably half the membership is African American to this day, always a heavy concentration of blacks and white immigrants, mostly immigrants at the Sandhogs.
They are. Tom, what was your first SFPD assignment out of the academy?
I first was sent to Central Station, which is North Beach, Chinatown, the Tenderloin, that whole area where your favorite bar was down in Fisherman's Wharf, Drury Deli Square, that whole area too. And I worked there for several years on patrol and was promoted in 1990, and I went down to the Hall of Justice where I worked as well, we call them inspectors, but detectives on the East Coast, you call them, and I worked downtown for doing that for the rest of my career, which was about 27 years.
Was the reception better once you had completed the academy to women?
Oh, definitely, definitely. And you know, I don't want to give the impression that everybody was negative, because that's not at all how it was. I mean, my classmates were great. I have really good friends who I went through the academy with, and the men I went through with were very supportive, and my partners were all always great, mostly guys that I worked with, and all of that. So, you know, once I got through the training, I'm really glad I did it. It was all pretty much interesting, and I really loved my job, so I'm glad I did it. It was worth it.
You mentioned, and I was going to ask this question, that both when you're in the academy and as a probationary officer, you were worried about your mother showing up at your workplace and causing embarrassment. Did it ever happen at all during your career?
Yeah, it finally did happen. I was sent to a demonstration. It was during, it might have been Desert Storm. It was one of, I'm pretty sure it was Desert Storm. And she was demonstrating in front of the federal building, and they sent a bunch of squads down just to sort of get the people out of the street because they were blocking traffic. And as we got there, I looked over and I recognized one of the protesters as my mother, who was in full manic, you know, a full manic state, just ranting and raving and so on. And I had my helmet on and the visor was down. So there was no way she could really recognize me. And I was really torn there for a minute. It was like, should I try to save her? Should I, you know, get her out of the situation? Should I let her be arrested? And so that was, you know, it was one of those moments where my worst fears were happening. And fortunately, I personally did not have to arrest her, but she did go downtown, and, you know, it was just a demonstration, so she didn't stay long. She was cited out along with everyone else.
You mentioned your promotion. You promoted to a position that I know in the NYPD is a high-profile and much coveted position. Is it also the same in SFPD? And tell us about the transition.
Yeah, I think it was pretty people really wanted that the job. For me, it was something I always wanted to be a homicide inspector. That was sort of a dream I had along the way, and I didn't know if I would ever achieve that. But when I first was promoted, I went to accident investigations. I went to hit and run detail, and we did all of the felony drunk driving and fatal accidents and police chases where somebody was injured, serious things like that that involved cars. And that was really good for me at the time because I was having children and we had small children at home and the hours were sort of predictable. I did go on call, but it wasn't an office where things were happening constantly and you were constantly having to go into work. So when my kids were little, that was great. And when they got bigger, I had the opportunity to go to homicide, and I spent the last 5 or so years of my career at homicide. And it was really cool. You know, you feel like everything you've learned, you finally get to use. You're finally at the top of the food chain in terms of, you know, you've learned how to write search warrants, but you've never had to use one before, or not that often. And now you're doing all this stuff every single day. You're using all your interview techniques. You're learning how to read people. All the things that you've learned for 20 years, you're now putting into play on the job, and that was really satisfying. It was, and I felt like I was just kind of getting good at the job when I left.
Are there any memorable cases that you'd like to mention that you were involved in?
I can't think of any offhand that would ring a bell for you guys. I mean, one of the jokes in our unit was, for some reason, I guess because it's the only serial killer San Francisco has ever been famous for, but the Zodiac Killer is still something that people talk about in San Francisco, even though he really only killed one person in San Francisco. But they have to keep an open case on that just because it was an unsolved mystery. And so whenever a new guy comes to the office, they will give him this gigantic box full of hundreds and hundreds of tips on the so-called Zodiac. And, you know, my dad was the Zodiac or my uncle was the Zodiac. And somebody has to go check those ridiculous things out, even though everyone sort of believes at this point the Zodiac Killer died a long time ago in prison or somewhere. But, so that's kind of funny. But, yeah, I had lots of interesting cases. I had a couple of federal cases. I had a really convoluted Hell's Angels case and all sorts of things. But that's for the next book.
I know that in addition to having 29 years on the job, you had a health issue. I hope that's well behind you.
Oh, yes, that's behind me. Yeah, and another one of my strange psychic moments, I told my boss at homicide that the job was killing me. That was after my partner got promoted, and I was feeling just really overwhelmed with all the cases that, you know, you start out, you're juggling, and they just keep throwing more and more at you, and you feel like you're not doing a good job on anything. And so one day I finally went into my boss and I said, I feel like this job is killing me. And so he said, well, I'm going to get you out of here. And so he transferred me. And about 2 weeks later, I found a lump in my breast. And it turned out I had breast cancer. So my intuition was correct, but the job was definitely taking its toll on me.
When did you begin to consider becoming a professional writer?
What happened was after the whole treatment, during the treatment, the cancer treatment, I thought, you know what, I've never told my kids the story of my life. They don't know why I have no relationship with my family, why I'm sort of an orphan kind of person and all of that. And so I thought, you know what, if I don't write this now, I wasn't sure if I was going to make it through the whole cancer treatment, which thank goodness I did. I'm happy I'm still here. But I wanted them to know all the things that I had never told them just because they were either too depressing or I just didn't think it was appropriate to tell a kid the stories that are in the book.
So the book was your first published writing?
It was. I entered a contest with an essay I wrote, and I won that. And I had done some other little essays and things like that, but this was the first time I was published.
Good Cop, Bad Daughter, in addition to being very well written, is brutally frank. Was there still anger toward your mother when you started the book? And if so, did writing it dissipate that anger at all?
Yeah, you know, I think that I could not write it until I was the age that I was. By the time I wrote it, my anger was pretty much gone towards her. I had moved into forgiveness. And I think if you write from the point of view of anger, it's going to come across, it won't be very interesting to the reader because you're portraying yourself as a victim and nobody's 100% a villain. So that's just not interesting and it's not realistic. People are, and I think as time went on, I began to realize that, you know, my mother did the best she could. Whatever she gave me was probably a lot more than whatever she received. Who knows what she came from because she never really talked much about that. And so writing it really did help me see how all of the little pieces of my life were all sort of connected, like that Carole King song, Tapestry. You know, it's like every single thread of your life is connected to one prior. And since I'm happy with the way my life turned out in the end, I have to be happy for the beginning as well. And as a writer, you couldn't ask for a better childhood than I had because she gave me so much material.
Did she know you were working on the book partly about the relationship with her?
She is and has been fairly, I would say she's suffering from Alzheimer's pretty seriously. So I don't think she would even begin to understand that I had written a book, or I could probably sit there and read her my book and she probably would not recognize it as being people she knew. Our last conversation, she did not know who I was, but remembered that she did have a daughter, Karen, and that Karen had been killed by her police squad. So I think in her mind, I had become some sort of Serpico character that had to be done away with because I had snitched on my team or something. I don't know. So she didn't know. She did not know.
Alzheimer's is just awful. My brother, who was 16 years older than I am, was he's the best person that I ever knew, the most Christian person. And he, in the end, he didn't know who I was. He didn't know who my wife was. And Kate Alzheimer's for a good 10 years before he died. It was awful.
Oh, it is terrible.
Chick, you've been listening. Do you have any questions for Karen, or do you have any comments?
Well, not really. I was listening, and I was, what's the right word, fascinated that Karen realized that she had, as some people would describe, a real rough childhood, but learn from it and mom probably came from someplace worse and it doesn't sound like she's walking around with a grudge because of that childhood and appreciates what she got from it. You know, like I discovered at the age of 72 that I had lived my life with dyslexia, and it explained so many of the things that happened to me in my childhood. There were times I was called stupid, and I realize now most of the people who did that were stupid themselves. But of course, you know, it's a child, you don't know. There were times when teachers would yell at me, "You're not paying attention," or, you know, "You're not listening," or, you know, and that was part of who I was. I am who I am, and I'm happy being who I am. And as I look back in my childhood, I know I'm lucky that if I did have issues or problems, in my case, I had a family that loved me, brothers, sisters, and cousins. And so it was like, it was Hillary, I think, that coined the thing about it takes a village to raise a child. Well, in my case, it took a family and a neighborhood. And I can see some similarities in Karen's story. And it's great to be able to live long enough to write about it.
Karen,
I'm glad for that.
One of the interesting things is that the knowing Chick, and it's 70 years, he was always extremely quick and extremely glib. So you would think that he was very intelligent. And then, since I didn't go to school with him and I didn't see what was going on in the school, to see that he got thrown out of a Catholic high school and he didn't finish high school, the immediate reaction was that he just didn't try. And you found out later that he was trying, was very frustrated. Well, he went he went through his life, and even before he knew his dyslexia, and he got the master's from Harvard. So he was able to
That's fantastic.
Overcome that. Wow, yeah.
That's amazing. And I think that, you know, really those types of disabilities were not even detected until a few decades ago. I mean, when we were kids, nobody paid much attention to, you know, different ways of learning and issues people had. And thank goodness, finally, people are realizing we don't all learn the same way.
There was a young lady from my old neighborhood who used to say that to nuns that special education was one across the knuckles, you know, so.
Oh, yes. And that was part of my mother's upbringing, too. She had been hit many times by nuns with rulers and, you know, all of that stuff. So I'm sure she had no picnic. She grew up in Brooklyn. So, yeah, she definitely had a different sort of childhood than I did in terms of discipline and things like that.
What's next for you, Karen?
Well, we've been working on trying to make Good Cop into a television series. So I'm working with some people in LA for that. And I'm working on another book about, it's going to be more like vignettes of police work. And so far I'm just starting that. I'm not really, not where I want to be with it, but, you know, hopefully I'll get going on that. I got a little distracted with the election and all that kind of drama.
Do you have good discipline though? I were able to block out part of the day and just continue with your writing?
I would say I'm more of a binge writer. I get excited about an idea and then I will just sit down and write for until I don't feel like writing anymore and then, you know, come back to it later. I'm not very disciplined in terms of sitting there every day and writing, and I really admire people who can do that, and I hope maybe someday I'll somehow get that ability. But so far I have not done it on a daily basis, and that's kind of frustrating to me.
Chick was lucky that his co-writer Joanna Malloy, and Chick really did the storytelling, and it's one of the great storytellers that I know. We've spent many times talking about politics and the old neighborhood and things like this. His co-author, who actually did much of the writing, if not a large majority, captured his voice tremendously well. Knowing him for so long and reading the book, it's as though he's talking to me. It was a terrific job.
And, wow.
And that bears it out. I mean, he's been signing all over the place to a New York Times article about the book. Hopefully it'll be very successful, as I hope you will be with yours.
Thank
you. We've covered a lot of ground tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about Karen Lynch? Karen?
Oh, I'm sorry. I lost you for a second.
We've covered a lot of ground tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about Karen Lynch?
Well, you know, I guess my message and the book's message is that don't ever underestimate how much influence one adult can have on a child's life. That's a really important thing to know, that if you have children in your life who maybe are living in situations that are less than ideal, if you can be that one point person for them, you can be the difference between them ending up a drug addict on the street or having a good life, you know? And I think that's really what saved me, and it's what saves a lot of kids. And I'm not saying that all kids who end up drug addicts did not have parents who love them, because that happens too, and that's a whole other can of worms. But just for all of us to do what we can to help the kids out there who need the help and the support.
Chick, do you have anything else for Karen?
No, I'm going to get the book, though. I know that.
Maybe thank you, Chick. I'm going to get yours, too. I can't wait to read it.
Thank you, Karen.
Well, thank you, Karen, and thank you, Chick. It's been a real pleasure. A bit of commercial.
Thank you so much, John.
A bit of commercial information. My books are available at Amazon, as are Karen and Chick's, and I blog at medium.com and publish the daily paper mentioned above. Send any comments or questions to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after Mets win, put it in the book. I hope you'll join us in 2 weeks for my interview with Roxanne Bland, and every other week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And for Karen's Neighborhood, we'll take us off for Tony Bennett.
The loveliness of Paris seems somehow sadly gay. The glory that was Rome is of another day. I've been terribly alone and forgotten in Manhattan. I'm going home to my city by the bay. I left my heart in San Francisco. High on a hill.
So good night, everybody.
Good night, Johnny.
It calls
Thank you, John.
To me.